Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We are live worldwide on the award-winning Close Up Radio, a service of the Telly Award-winning Close Up Television Radio. This is your host, Jim Masters, and it's a real pleasure to continue our conversations with the extraordinary Dr. Michael Armour. If you've been following along with our series and you've been hearing some extraordinary content being provided through our conversations, Dr. Mike truly is an expert in his field, but also he's a forward thinker on many levels. He's a problem solver, he's curious, and he loves to help people on many different levels. For decades, he has compiled an exceptional leadership record in far-ranging fields of endeavor. He is absolutely a multi-dimensional achiever, and he consistently is in demand as an executive coach, business advisor, and trainer focused on management, leadership, cultural transformation, and other aspects of enhancing performance at both individual and organizational levels. After sharing his insights in face-to-face meetings and speaking engagements for so long, Dr. Mike recently ventured into podcasts talking about themes top of mind in the C-suite. We've had him here on Close-Up Radio. We've done close-up television shoots with him as well, in studio and on location, and that has been a true blessing as well. And he also posts videos to his updated website. If you haven't seen the updated websites, definitely check that out. He holds a PhD from UCLA and has achieved triumphs in some of the most challenging leadership scenarios, and that has included turning around organizations that were headed for collapse. Therefore, he is uniquely qualified to help any organization in any location or industry to face challenges such as economic downturns, geographically dispersed team members, and the eroding sense of accountability in the workplace. For years, companies and their leaders have grappled with what accountability is and how to achieve it more effectively. Over 80% of managers acknowledge their inability to hold others accountable successfully. Crucial concept for discussion, absolutely. And you can hear, again, Mike Armour's take in these conversations, as well as his strategies for improving a recently dismal outlook on accountability. Now, last week he was with us as we kicked off our June series together, and we were talking about, is accountability eroding? And he pointed out several key points about how it is. And, you know, he not only talked about the fact that it is, but reasons why and different scenarios that tie into the conversation. Now we're going to be talking about why is accountability losing ground. Before, we talked about the fact that it is on the episode last week. On this week's episode, why is accountability losing ground? So check that out if you didn't hear part one of this particular June series about strengthening accountability. Last week, we discussed a widespread perception that accountability is receding in our culture, and Dr. Mike concurred. We're going to be talking about particular reasons why accountability has lost so much ground. Let's welcome him back live and direct from the great American city of Dallas, Texas. Dr. Mike, welcome back to Close Up Radio. Always a privilege and a pleasure, and we welcome you back to the show.
Well, thank you. It's always a joy to be in conversation with you and to have other people listening in to what we talk about.
I really enjoyed it as well because, again, you leave us with these thought-provoking ideas and lots of inspiration tied to it, but not just talk, action, following the conversation, which I think is very, very important, and that ties into accountability. I know on the podcast, Upsize Your Leadership, you recently singled out five social and cultural factors which have undermined accountability. At the top of the list was the breakdown of home. How has family breakdown contributed to diminished accountability? And it's also contributed to just a diminishment in many aspects of society as well.
Well, you're absolutely right on that. And one of the reasons that it's critical in terms of accountability is because we really must learn accountability in childhood. We're not born accountable. In fact, we're born rather selfish and defensive. And we have to learn how to take responsibility, how to acknowledge that we made a mistake, how to apologize when appropriate, to make amends when appropriate. And those have always been values instilled in the home, in the interaction between parents and children, between siblings, between grandparents and children, between more distant relatives and children. Everyone in that larger family saw it as part of their mission to help this child learn what it means to be a responsible, accountable contributor to the world in which that child has been born. That has largely been diminished to a point that I'm seeing more and more young people coming out of their childhood experience with a very shriveled sense of personal accountability, or even the other side of that, personal responsibility. You know, I can't be held accountable for something that I don't have the ability to respond to. So responsibility comes first, and then accountability comes with it. And the breakdown of the home has impacted that. Now, what do I mean by the breakdown of the home? Well, let's go back to my youth. I had a pretty active network of friends. Yet in that network of friends, divorce was so rare that apart from the kids of war widows, I had very few friends, two or three at most, all the way through my childhood and adolescent years, two or three who were growing up in single-parent homes. It was just not something that we knew in many, many communities. We assumed a family intact. Today, 18 million children are growing up in single-parent homes. The average length of a first marriage is now 8 years. Now think about that. Child's not even into adolescence before the marriage breaks up. And if there is a second marriage, the average length of second marriages is only 10 years. And so there's a real discontinuity in the life of the child at those stages of development where responsibility and accountability are normally learned. As a result, more and more people are coming into adulthood with a very immature sense of what it means to be accountable. Now, when we can add to that, that because of this chaos in the child's formative years, a lot of damage is done to self-worth. And I'm not talking about self-esteem here. I'm talking about self-worth. Self-worth is fundamentally an answer to three questions. Is there any value to who I am? Is there any value to what I do? And is there any value to what I may become? Form a sense of self-worth in childhood, largely in around the feedback we get from our family and very closest circle of friends. But if that network is disrupted because the family is torn apart, if I'm oscillating back and forth between one parent's home and another, and in the midst of this trying to adjust to a new parent who has come into one or both of those homes by way of marriage, the consistent affirming message of my self-worth does not get reinforced. Now, how does self-worth have anything to do with accountability? If I do not see myself as a person of worth, a person of value, a person who is valuable not just because of what he does, but even more valuable because of who he is, I lose a sense that I need to be accountable. I'm not worth anything. I'm not someone that people treasure. So why do I need to be accountable? And the self-worth crisis is as great as our accountability crisis, evidenced by the very high level of drug addiction among teenagers, the very high suicide rate, an alarmingly high suicide rate that is now prevalent among people who are at the stage of life where they ought to have the most energy, the most opportunity, optimistic outlook, and the most sense of promise of good things lying ahead. That's not the kinds of teenagers we're seeing in many, many instances. And that depression and suicidality and addiction that has become so commonplace among teens from every walk of life is then a further sign that the self-worth is so low that the sense of accountability is likewise pretty minimal.
Let alone the dependency on numbing agents like drugs and you know, fentanyl and all of the opioids, all these things that have come into play that are running rampant too, which are not the best way to deal with a lot of the different things in life we all have to deal with. So all of these factors you're talking about are so intertwined and tied together. And we do seem to be in a, you know, society where even on social media and in the public eye, there is little accountability. And when somebody does something or says something and the public at large doesn't like it, then they'll retract it. Then they'll apologize, but only after there's a furor and there's a chance of losing money and profitability and things of that nature, then they'll think to do you think sometimes people jump the gun as opposed to, remember when you used to think before you hit send, think before you would say something? Now people do it and then they have to apologize after. That's creating an issue too.
Well, and the other thing is, now this, you know, really dates me, but in an era when we did not have computers and many of us didn't even have typewriters, communication we sent to people was largely written. And when you are taking the time to handwrite things, you think them through more than you do if you just dash them off in 10 seconds on a keyboard. And so one of the things that has happened is that the ease and the speed with which we can disseminate our thoughts no longer requires the time and the reflection that's going to happen if we're handwriting notes or handwriting messages. And so that, too, has contributed to this type it and hit send with no time spent thinking through what the consequences might be if someone read what we just said in the wrong light or put the wrong twist on words or simply was offended by us even raising the subject.
Exactly right. It used to be think before you put the stamp on the envelope and mail it.
Yeah, yes, and it was going to be a delay between the time you put the stamp on it and you got it in the post office box. So you had
time
to think things over before you hit send.
Right. And a second factor which you identify as undermining accountability is massive urbanization. Tell us about that, Dr. Mike.
The very nature of urbanization is that we become anonymous. We become another face in the crowd. We walk the street and see lots of people, but we don't see lots of connections. People are just like the cars passing by or the birds flying overhead. They are just part of the scene. And we therefore, not having a sense of connection, sometimes don't really have a sense of accountability to those people. The scene that I remember from childhood that is so different from what I see in my own community today is that when a tornado or a major storm hit the area, immediately everybody was in the streets trying to help one another. Today, the storm hits the streets, and the people who are trying to help can't get their work done because there are so many gawkers coming by just to take in the spectacle. Not interested in stopping and helping, not there to offer a helping hand. They just want to see what has happened. And that's the kind of disconnect I'm talking about. When I was a senior in high school, I was doing some research in the city library, which through its south windows looked out over the town. And as I was sitting there, I saw a tornado drop out of the sky and came across, destroyed 85 buildings and homes in the town. And it took the roof off of a supermarket that was just a block away. This was a Saturday afternoon, farming community, everybody's in town shopping. And so as soon as the debris quit falling, I took off of that supermarket because I had friends who worked there, and I could just see people buried under shelves that had fallen or injured by flying products, and I was going to get over there and help. But by the time 10 or 15 minutes passed, we had dozens of people in there trying to be sure that no one was injured and taking care of those who were. Such a different world from a world in which we respond to spectacle by being a gawker. So that's just one of many ways in which urbanization depersonalizes those around us and therefore dulls our sense of accountability to them.
Same way when they're driving past an accident on the highway and rubbernecking, mm-hmm. and then ending up causing more accidents because they're looking at the
yes.
northbound lanes where the accident is instead of just making sure that they're driving correctly on the southbound lanes.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I never do that. I never look to in those directions unless there's somebody who's trying to flag me down for help.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to, you know, that's a tragedy that's happening there, and
right.
they have the people there taking care of them, and it's a gawking thing, which is, yeah, that's always turned me off as well, and I think we're kindred spirits on that. If we continue with that list that you've devised of influences which adversely impact accountability, your third item, and it's a biggie, is political polarization, and that we've seen rise to the surface more than ever in recent years from all angles. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that point?
Well, it is, as you
we
say.
We may need an hour for that.
Only 1 hour?
Right. 1 hour and some Tums with it.
Well, as you say, everybody sees it, and everybody is now talking about it. It's not brand new, but it is newer than people who are in their 30s and below may realize. The day of gentlemanly debate in politics has completely disappeared. And what we're dealing with now is a world in which it's very difficult to get anything done in state houses or in Washington, because the polarization is so deep that people on neither side of the debate can afford to try to find compromise ground without being shot in the back by their own people. And it doesn't matter whether you're on the left or right. Both sides are very insistent on loyalty tests for those who hold public office. And so the days of the great compromisers are gone. I ran for Congress in 2002, and I had a campaign manager who had run a number of congressional and Senate campaigns, and we lost the primary by a few dozen votes. And he and I were having just a drink afterwards, reflecting on what had happened. And I remember he paid me one of the greatest compliments anyone's ever paid me. He looked over at me and he said, "It's always a disappointment when I lose. This one is more disappointing than any I can remember, because we don't have any statesmen left, and I thought that you had the potential to become one." And what a sad comment that somebody who has been in the thick of politics for years and years would say, "We don't have any statesmen left." But the fact of the matter is, we are so polarized, it's hard for anyone to be a statesman. And in that world, now then, to destroy the other side, we're not bound by truth. We're not bound by rules of fair play. We're not bound by rules of polite engagement. It's whatever it takes to win. And so our children are growing up seeing their leadership stoop to whatever maneuver or trick they can pull out of the hat to win the argument, rather than looking for the deeper truth that we can all agree on and rally around in order to solve the problem. So this political polarization impacts us in a number of ways, but one that doesn't get addressed much and yet needs to be is the impression it leaves on young people on how people ought to settle differences and how they ought to treat people on the other side of those differences.
Exactly right. Exactly. Coming to the table, at least, is a big, important part of all of this. And speaking of politics, some people would consider, you know, the last two things on your list as maybe politically controversial, but there is a fourth factor, which is diminished accountability, as the emergence of this victimhood mentality has risen to the surface as well. Tell us about your perspective on that. I mean, it's as if we're living in a land where if you say hello with a tone that somebody misinterprets, you're attacking, and there's a victim involved.
Yeah, right. You know, I grew up in the segregated South, where there was racial discrimination. There was gender discrimination. It was very clear, very obvious, and many people who held those views were unapologetic about them. I happened to come along at the point that those prevailing attitudes were finally being challenged openly and pointedly in public discourse and public debate. I ran for student body president when I was in college, and it was an all-white school. And I ran on a campaign to force the integration of that school and easily got the majority vote of the student body. Misgivings about some who were donors and supporters of the school and the community. And within a year and a half after I left the campus, the first black students were admitted. So we were breaking those barriers where there really were people who were victims. But the victims got so much attention and so much support that it seems to me that over time more and more people wanted to be identified with the victim class. And even though the injustice they may have suffered was not much more than a slight, certainly wasn't the kind of things that we were addressing in the heavily racially prejudiced, exploitive world of many southern communities and northern communities. I mean, racism was rampant across the country. Nonetheless, people want to be identified as a victim. And now then, as you say, it seems that the slightest little lack of consideration or thoughtlessness in some way gets interpreted as, I'm a victim and you're an oppressor. And once we start dividing the world into victims and oppressors, we don't feel much accountability to an oppressor. And one of the things that is happening very recently is we're getting these notions that if you're of a certain race or a certain gender or a certain socioeconomic status, by default, you are an oppressor. And so in a world like that, the sense of accountability is inevitably going to shrivel because oppressors are not seen as really human. They are animals. We don't have to be accountable to them. And therefore, that issue is one that we've got to address and soften the tendency for everyone to want to wear the name victim.
That's right, exactly. And it's important for people to really pay heed to that on every level possible. You know, in identifying developments which have done damage to accountability, you had concluded your list with the loss of the Judeo-Christian ethical consensus. Now, I know you well enough that I don't think that you're advocating some type of state religion, but tell us about what your thoughts are on all of this.
When our country was founded, not everyone was religious. A lot of people were not particularly religious. Certainly in the days that we were spreading out across the western United States, had you gone to those rough towns along the American frontier, you would have found a lot of pretty tough hombres, people who lived hard, who fought hard, who drank hard. They were the last people you would expect to see in church on Sundays. But there was sort of universal agreement that the principles of the Ten Commandments were the way that people ought to live, that the principles of the Sermon on the Mount were really great guidelines for building strong families, strong lives, strong communities. That consensus is largely gone. It's very difficult to even indirectly refer to principles drawn from the Bible or from the Judeo-Christian heritage without being accused of what you said in your introduction. You're trying to impose a state religion. No, we're not trying to impose a state religion. We're simply saying that the consensus we once had around those values is what gave us our great national strength and prosperity and why we became the envy of people in nations all around the world whose nation was built around ideologies that were far from the concepts of accountability and responsibility and neighborliness that were at the heart of the Judeo-Christian ethic. And when the Soviet Union fell, I spent several years working with educators in Russia who were trying to reinstate the Judeo-Christian ethic in the schools because the elimination of it under Marxism had led to such total deterioration of their society and their culture, so that there were virtually no ethical guidelines that people felt compelled to obey. It was an ugly, ugly scenario, and teachers and educators were desperate to find a way to rebuild an ethical basis, and they turned to their historic heritage and the Judeo-Christian tradition for that foundation. So I've seen what happens in the long run when those principles of accountability and responsibility and respect for law and others and for neighborliness that have always permeated the Judeo-Christian ethic, when those get marginalized and minimized, the end product after a generation or two is not very pretty. And I think we're on a path in that direction. We're not to the point of no return, but I think we've already taken too many steps in that direction, to be quite honest.
A couple of websites our listeners can go to, leaderperfect.com and also michaelarmor.com to connect with our very special guest, Dr. Michael Armor. Dr. Armor, these shows go by in New York minutes. 30 minutes has come and gone, but always a pleasure. And again, love these conversations because you have really broken this down in ways that everything that you're talking about can be applied to our daily lives. And it's positive and it's forward movement and it's really encouraging that these opportunities exist and you help your clients get the ball rolling to facilitate some of these important things, like we're talking about something as basic as accountability. So I encourage folks to go to the websites leaderperfect.com or michaelarmor.com, and armor is spelled A-R-M-O-U-R, michaelarmor.com. Dr. Mike, thanks for joining us. Looking forward to chatting with you as we go along here. Extraordinary conversation today, and hope you enjoy the time with me as much as I absolutely have with you.
Oh, it was a joy. You always have interesting perspectives to add to my thoughts. I appreciate it very much.
The pleasure is all ours, and I want to let everybody know that this entire episode is recorded in full and available in the archives. We thank Dr. Michael Armor. We thank you, Jim Masters, thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, here on Close Up Radio, and I invite you to stay right there and be back momentarily with another fascinating guest celebrated here on Close Up Radio. Till then, for all of us, have a great day. Bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.